Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Wednesday, June 4th. I'm Shane Dawson. You're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, we have a midweek Gaelic Games trifecta. Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray have all the latest from the Ladies Football and Camogie Championships, while Damien Lawler chats through all the notable GAA stories from this week. Plus, Mark Langdon brings us the big football transfers from across Europe. And of course, we'll round up today's sports news headlines. So if you want to get in touch, you can text 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Hello, hello, good evening, welcome along to the show, welcome along to an hour of sport. Lots to get through this evening before we chat Gaelic Games and before we cross live to Mark Langdon in chat. European football transfers and football news, some rugby news. Craig Casey will captain Ireland for their summer tour of Georgia and Portugal, while there are 11 uncapped players named in the squad. Interim head coach Paul O'Connell has named a 32-man squad for the tests on the 5th and 12th of July. Munster scrum half Casey will be the 112th player to captain his country. Alex Kendallin, Darren Murray, Paddy McCarthy, Stephen Smith and Hugh Gavin have been called up for the first time, while Tom O'Hearn, Michael Milne, Shane Bolton, Nathan Doak, Ben Murphy and Tommy O'Brien will look for their first caps, having previously trained with the senior squad. After recently returning from long-term injuries, Ulster forwards Ian Henderson and Rob Herring were not considered for selection to allow them to focus on a full pre-season programme, while Leinster centre Robbie Henshaw was not available due to injury. Connacht's Finlay Beelam is the most experienced player in the squad with 51 caps. You can view the full squad on the RTE Sport website and the RTE News app. Some racing news as well before we turn our attention to association football. The line in winter will have to defy stall 19 of the one-time anti-post favourite for the Betfred Derby as they bounce back at Epsom, where he was overlooked by Ryan Moore in favour of Delacroix. Aidan O'Brien's Colt, who will be ridden by Colin Keane, lost his unbeaten record in the Dante as well as aiming to emulate Workforce and overcoming defeat at York to prevail in the Blue Riband. He now has the widest draw of all to overcome. Stablemate and current market leader Delacroix is berthed in stall 14, while O'Brien's third representative, Lamburn, the Chester Vase winner, is in stall 10 under Wayne Lorden. Charlie Appleby's 2000 Guineas winner, Ruling Court, drew stall 7 for the first time ever. The race was subject to 72-hour declarations, with Epsom hoping to change helps to build anticipation ahead of the Premier Classic.
Game On. Association football.
But Mark Langdon joins us on the line now to chat through some transfer news in Ireland and Britain across Europe. Mark Langdon, let us begin our conversation with Caoimhín Keller with my green tinted glasses on. Now, we discussed this with Paul yesterday briefly about that it will be or could be a good move for Caoimhín Keller. However, with Thomas Frank linked to Spurs, Brian Mbeumo on the way out, could this be a very different Brentford Caoimhín Keller are signing for?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. You would have said the same this time last year, though, wouldn't you? Ivan Toney departed. I think with Brentford, it's not necessarily about the kind of the people that you see on the touchline and on the pitch. It's what they do off the pitch that has made them an established Premier League team. And I think that the way that they function, so clever, Matthew Benham, somebody that came through as betting background, all the data analysts that they've got, working, I don't really like the phrase Moneyball, but some people have said it's the Moneyball equivalent. They are a team that is so well run. If you go back to, you remember when Dean Smith was in charge at Brentford, and everybody thought that he was a really special coach, and I don't want to just say he's a load of rubbish, because he's clearly not. But, you know, Thomas Frank was not seen as kind of this great tactician when he replaced Dean Smith. But it's about the system and the philosophy and processes that Brentford have got in place. So I think Kelleher, you know, whatever the Brentford team lines up next season, whoever the coach is, they would have done their homework. They would have made sure that they've got a good person that you kind of, you know, and Bueno's set to leave probably to go to Manchester United. They've probably already got his replacement lined up because that's the way that they work Brentford. You know, they couldn't replace Ivan Toney. It was impossible for them to just directly replace Toney. But what they did was in Sharda and Bueno and Rissa, they've managed to create sort of a front three that scores just as many goals or even more goals than what Ivan Toney was able to do. So I wouldn't be fearing for them in terms of relegation next season, or sort of really struggling at the bottom end of the Premier League. I think, you know, they'll do just fine. They'll be a mid-table side, and I think one area actually where they could improve from this season would be in goal. I'm not sure that Flacken covered himself in glory. So, in my opinion, they've definitely made an upgrade in that area and is the kind of signing that you would expect of Brentford. I think for, you know, was it under £20 million? I think you've got somebody that is a Premier League goalkeeper. He's just really unlucky that he was playing second fiddle to one of the best in the world in Alisson.
Yeah, given the modern riches of the game, and I know I've made this point earlier in the week, but is £20 million, like, is that a bit cheap?
I'd say it's on the cheaper side. I mean, goalkeepers tend to go for a lot less than strikers. They're not valued as highly. They probably make less difference overall, because I think most of them kind of are similar-ish level. I think in terms of strikers, for instance, you get absolutely world-class ones that really propel a team. I think with a goalkeeper, you can occasionally get that, but what you don't want is a bad one. It's more about making sure you don't find a goalkeeper that makes lots of mistakes. Kelleher doesn't do that. I think really, over the piece, I think Brentford have signed quite a few players from Liverpool, and I would have said that Liverpool have probably had the edge really in terms of those signings, but maybe this one balances out some of the others because, yeah, I would say for under 20 million, not much you can buy these days, as crazy as that sounds. And so I think it's probably a good deal for everybody. Liverpool have already got a replacement goalkeeper. Kelleher needs to play and Brentford need a goalkeeper. So it works out for absolutely everyone.
Speaking of price tags, and indeed speaking of Liverpool, is Florian Wirtz worth €150 million?
I struggle to say anybody is worth €115 million. I think what Wirtz is going to do for Liverpool, is to replace the creativity. As crazy as this sounds, you know, Trent Alexander-Arnold was such a cheap creator from right back, and, you know, unusual in the way that Liverpool relied on him to open up defences and make assists, that it would be impossible for them to find another right back that can do that. And Frimpong, while he's attacking, just doesn't have the same natural abilities as what Alexander Arnold has got, because he's almost like a playmaker from the right back position. And Wirtz is going to give them that sort of more traditional playmaker role. I think what he's really good at is finding space. Very intelligent player, will kind of occupy those spaces between the defence and the midfield, links up play, always seems to make the right decision. And, you know, I think he's one of the best young players in the world. Now, whether that means he'll settle straight away in the Premier League, I don't think you can be that confident either way, because I would have said Kai Havertz, you know, came with not too dissimilar reputation. He's won the Champions League, Kai Havertz, but he's probably never really lived up to the hype that he had in the Bundesliga. I think Wirtz is potentially better than Havertz, and Liverpool fans will be hoping that he is able to have the same impact. But there is always a doubt, I think, when you buy a young player from abroad, because, you know, you just cut it. Nothing's 100%, but he's definitely one of the best young players around. So he improves Liverpool on paper, at least.
Okay, Manchester City have agreed a fee with AC Milan for Dutch midfielder Tijani Reinders. City are set to pay €55 million for the 26-year-old who has agreed a 5-year contract to move to the Premier League. What player, what type of player are Manchester City getting here, Mark?
Yeah, I really like Reinders. He played in a poor Milan side this year, one that struggled. Even though they reached Italian Cup final, won the Italian Super Cup, they really struggled in the league. He's a dynamic player from midfield, and I think the one thing that I certainly felt that City lacked this season was dynamism, and particularly in midfield. You know, they had De Bruyne, they had Bernardo Silva. They had a lot of players that were going towards the ball rather than making runs beyond and sort of getting in support of Haaland. And Reinders is very good on the ball, but he will make forward runs and he can score goals from that midfield area. So not a like-for-like for Kevin De Bruyne, because he, the way that he could see a pass and deliver those passes was, very special. But I think he'll suit Guardiola's style of play in terms of keeping the ball, not losing it in silly positions, but he will try to get forward and score goals. And, that City side, particularly with Foden not having an amazing season in the one that's just gone, they did lack goals in sort of, in those midfield positions, because Doku doesn't score many goals. Savinho doesn't score many. Foden was out of form and out of favour. You know, Bernardo Silva, another one that doesn't really get enough goals. So there was so much pressure on Haaland. Marmoush came in, and then it's about how can you play those two together. But I think that Reinders is definitely an upgrade on what City have got. And I really like this signing. I think that he's at the right age to come to the Premier League. And, City are definitely throwing a few euros at it. If you think about all the signings they made in January as well, this is really a kind of revolution, really, to the Manchester City team. The one that starts the season next year, I don't think will look anything like the one that started the campaign that's just ended. And that's really unusual for a top team to go through so much change. But I think it's clearly needed.
Yeah, Ryan Ait Nouri also heavily linked with a move to City. The Athletic are reporting that Jack Grealish is likely to be left out of City's Club World Cup squad. So is the writing on the wall in terms of his departure?
Yeah, I would have thought so. He's won everything there is really to win at Manchester City. So, from that point of view, you feel like Grealish has done his job. But, that on paper, that might be true. But anybody that sort of watched him, he hasn't had the impact that he would have wanted. £400 million when he joined from Aston Villa. Pep Guardiola clearly doesn't trust him or sort of want that type of player in the team. He's made that fairly obvious, I would say, with his team selection over the past 6 months or so. So he definitely needs a move, Jack Grealish. And it wasn't that long ago he was seen as the chief creator for England and one of the best sort of talents around. So I'm sure there'll be a lot of teams, even on high wages, that will be more than happy to have Grealish in their squad for next season. But I can't see that being at Manchester City. And the one thing he does need to do, he needs to improve his image off the pitch, because I don't know if it's true or not, but the way that he's sort of portrayed in the media now is that sort of party boy, and he's sort of falling out of nightclubs, and that kind of reputation now is how Jack Grealish is labelled. And I think he just needs to get back to his football. He needs to be happy. He needs to be playing somewhere where he is loved. I could see him at a Newcastle. You could see him maybe at Tottenham.
I think he'll return to
Aston Villa.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could see it in terms of the way that he plays. It's just whether there've been some burnt bridges. He's very much a Villa supporter. It ended in such a bad way. I'm not sure if the fans would be delighted to have Grealish back, but I think it would make a lot of sense. Although they're in the Europa League, there's a lot of games to be played next season, and you need a big squad, and they've lost Rashford, lost Asensio, so they definitely need numbers in there.
Yeah, I think it would be very much a case of what Jack Grealish would be returning if that was the case. And what is the current attraction for players like Matheus Cunha and Brian Mbeumo to join Manchester United?
So I think this might depend on who you ask. I mean, if you're a cynic, you would say the wages that they offer, and it's still as good as most in the Premier League. If you asked sort of Cunha and Waymo, they would probably say it's the challenge of restoring Manchester United to their kind of place back in the upper echelons of the Premier League. There is definitely something about that, isn't there? You know, being that guy, that person that turns it all around, and kind of, if you feel like, you know, for Cunha's point of view, you could be a hero, wearing the number 10, delivering great performances. You would have seen, it was a long time ago, but you would have seen the sort of maverick in Eric Cantona sort of turn Manchester United around when he arrived from Leeds United. So that's the challenge. My sense is that, that's all well and good, but United pay extraordinary wages and get sort of very little return on that wage bill. But, it's one of the highest in world football. And as long as you pay the money, the players will come. Whether it's the right type of player is another question, but you will get players if you pay the wages.
Yeah, and I think there is still, even results, how they went last season, there is a bit of an aura for wearing a Manchester United jersey and lining out in Old Trafford. And Bruno Fernandes staying, might that be United's most important piece of business?
Well, I think for 100 million, I'm a big Fernandes fan, but I think for 100 million, it would have been a good deal for United to have tried something else. And, I understand why Fernandes doesn't want to go, because he wants to play at a higher level than the Saudi League. And he's still an influential and an important player for United. And I think he's over-criticised because he's their best player. When it goes wrong, it's almost like, why is he not doing more? When, if anything, he's almost doing too much at times for United, and tries to just be the hero, and it doesn't work out. But he probably looks up and thinks, well, I'm not passing to him and I can't pass to him, so I'll have to try to do it myself. But if you look at his age and the fact that United do want to try something else next season, like 100 million would have been a bonus that I think they probably couldn't have turned down. As it is, if he's staying, he's still a great player, but you were saying there that earlier on that Kelleher was good value under 20 million. I would have thought 100 million Fernandes was overpriced given his age.
Okay, I do want to pick your brain on some managerial movement in Serie A, but before we move further across Europe, Liam Delap to Chelsea, is that a good fit, and where else do you feel Chelsea need to strengthen?
In goal, I think Chelsea have got a lot of goalkeepers, but none that you would really trust to win you a Premier League, and that's what Chelsea should be aiming for over the next couple of seasons, and I don't think they've got one at the moment that is capable of sort of really hanging your hat on and saying, an Alisson type figure that can make that sort of extra couple of percent difference. In terms of Liam Delap, I think he'll do well at Chelsea if he's not asked to be the main striker. We've seen with Hoyland at United, just that the weight of pressure was too much for him, and he needed to play 20 minutes here, 30 minutes there, come into the team, come out of the team, and I think that's the same for Liam Delap. So it depends if Chelsea are asking him to be the player that's going to win them the Premier League, or just be part of the squad. If he's part of the squad, I think he's a great signing. I've seen him sort of in the flesh, and he is a real handful, a throwback of a centre forward, and different to what Chelsea have got at the moment. Nicholas Jackson, sort of, he's frustrating, he runs in behind, but he's often offside. Like, Delap will bully defenders and get on the end of crosses and just really be that sort of typical number nine. But I still wouldn't want him to be kind of playing 30 Premier League games next season for Chelsea if you're looking to win the league.
Just speaking of Chelsea goalkeepers, I think Chelsea were linked with Milan keeper Mike Maignan, but it's unlikely the Cubs will agree on a price, according to reports. For Spurs, our final word in the Premier League, according to the Telegraph, Sun has been linked with a move to Saudi Arabia, but the more pressing matter, is Ange staying, Mark, or what's the story?
this is incredible. I don't think anybody knows. I mean, I was sort of sent message. It was actually on the day of the parade, saying, Thomas Frank will be the new Tottenham manager. That was somebody that I would trust, not from within the club, just somebody within football that said that. And you know, there's been a lot of rumours since then that it will be Thomas Frank. But I think Daniel Levy is almost bottling the decision at the moment. There's definitely people at Tottenham that would like to see, I would say, sort of higher up, that would like to see a change. But I'm not sure if Levy is confident enough that kind of, you know, the fans would, the majority of fans are kind of behind Postecoglou. They want Ange to stay, and it will be such an unpopular decision. I'm not sure if Levy's got it in him to make that call at the moment. So I don't think anybody knows. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't Postecoglou or Thomas Frank in charge of Spurs next season. But in terms of which one it is, I've got absolutely no idea now.
Okay, well, one manager who has departed his club, Simeone Inzaghi, has left Inter Milan in the wake of their demolition by PSG in Saturday's Champions League final. The 49-year-old has been heavily linked with the job of Saudi Pro League side Al Hilal. Como head coach Cesc Fabregas linked as a replacement.
Yeah, well, Fabregas has done very well this season with Como, you know, safely tucked away in mid-table. I think that's a good season for them. Football, stylistically, was pleasing on the eye. You know, you wouldn't expect anything less, really, I don't think, from a Fabregas team. He's definitely not going to be lumping it up to the big man and sort of feeding off scraps. You know, he does want possession, wants to play, in inverted commas, you know, the right way. He's got a sort of ideology and a philosophy about the game that I think suits sort of big teams in European football. So I can understand the link to Inter. All I would say for Fabregas is that the Inter job is a difficult one. I think Inzaghi got every last bit that he could out of that team. And I know they fell short in the Champions League final, and it was an embarrassing way that they went out and lost that game. But this is a team that's got, you know, Mkhitaryan and Çalhanoğlu in central midfield, Acerbi, sort of veteran defender. You know, they have to sell players and replace them with ones that are not as good, because they just haven't got the money at the moment to kind of regenerate that squad. So I can understand why Inzaghi has left. I wish he wouldn't have gone to Saudi, you know, and stayed in European football, because you know, I think he's a coach that should be managing in the Champions League. There's, you know, a big financial package coming his way. And Fabregas will feel like it's a, you know, Inter is such a massive team that you can't turn that down. But it's a difficult one, because I think you're going into a club where I'm not sure how much improvement there is in the short term.
Okay, we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Mark Langdon, thank you so much. Plenty of managerial movement in Serie A, actually. Sarri back to Lazio, Gasperini to Roma, Pioli is the frontrunner for the Fiorentina job. And England under-21's head coach Lee Carsley has signed a new deal through to the end of the 2027 European Championship. Meanwhile, Michael Carrick has left his roles as Middlesbrough's head coach after the team finished 10th in the Championship last month. 51552 is the text number. Joe from Abbey League says, looking forward to football, hurling and camogie. Well, that's all coming up next, Joe.
Hurling.
Now, Damien Lawler is on the line with all the latest Gaelic Games talking points. Damien, a lot to focus on this weekend, particularly the Munster and Leinster hurling finals. However, we will be previewing them in detail on Friday's show. But on Sunday, before Kilkenny and Galway square off in Croke Park, Kildare play Laois in the Joe McDonagh final at 1:45 that afternoon. So a lot of the focus in the build-up, and understandably, to be fair, is on the rise of Kildare hurling. And the Lily Whites have a huge opportunity on Sunday. But I mean, it won't be easy against a dogged Laois side.
Oh, not at all, no. And like, I mean, Laois created 40 scoring chances in the final last year, Shane. They got beaten by, I think, just 3 points in the end. But like, they had 19 wides. And, you know, they got beaten by Offaly, who have gone on maybe to the Liam McCarthy Cup. But they played some unbelievable hurling that year. Now, to be truthful, I'm not sure if they're hurling as well this time around yet. But they were beaten by Kildare in the group stages of the Joe Mac just a few weeks ago in their own backyard. And having lost last year's final and having lost to Kildare a few weeks ago, Dander will certainly be up for Sunday's final. And I think in a county like Laois, there's a split there between football and hurling in the county. The people are working very, very hard to regenerate it again. The Satanta and Cúchulainn camps are working quite good. They had 360 young players hurling over a six-week period. And now the under-13s will play Offaly on Sunday, Shane, and they'll go straight from there to Croke Park to the Joe McDonagh Cup. And for any young Laois hurler to see the Laois captain David Dooley go up the steps of the Hogan Stand, lift the Joe McDonagh Cup final. Well, that will do more than anything could do in the space of a year, any development work, from the terms of pure promotion. What I'm trying to say to you is, at the moment, Kildare possibly playing the better hurling, but this, the experience of losing the Joe Mac final last year and getting Laois back to the Leinster Championship where they feel they should be, well, that'll make it really, really hard for Kildare to prevail on Sunday afternoon. It's going to be a tight game, Shane, no doubt about it.
Okay, well, let's hear from the Kildare captain now, Ryan Bourne, who you were speaking to, Damien.
The pathway has been good to develop as a hurler all the way up through the ranks. Would you go along with that?
Yeah, I would. I'd say it's definitely even improved in the last 10 years. There's been some huge work being done in Kildare GAA, from, you know, underage managers to you know, Kildare GAA and everything. There's been a real movement down the last 10-15 years that I'm very grateful for to be part of, you know.
From week to week then, have you found, I suppose, the standard of it, the intensity, the competitiveness, the physicality, are they all a step up from the Christy Ring level?
I definitely think so. There's no question about it. Yeah. Definitely the speed, even it's a lot of a faster, much faster game, and you know, maybe we learned quickly after the Kerry game that we needed to bring something more, and I'm just very grateful for, you know, the lads turning up against the second game and the Westmeath game.
That was a crucial result.
It really was, yeah. But in fairness, it wasn't really pressure that was driving us on. It was just you know, lads wanting to put out a performance there that was
effective of the work you put in.
Exactly, yeah.
David Hurdy did a right good job, and you know, so did Joe Quaid and all the managers before that. But what does Brian bring then, Ryan?
He brings a huge level of experience, and as well as that, he has he's a very honest and hardworking backroom management team as well. Yeah. But no, it means, you know, every time, you know, Kildare put over a point, you can see it in the replays on. You know, when you go home to look at the clips, you can see how much it means to them. So I think everyone's feeding off that, and feeding each other as well with the energy that we're bringing along. So
Kildare captain Ryan Bourne there speaking to Damien and speaking about Brian Dowling, and he's done some job with the Kildare management thus far. Right, call it for me, Damien. Who is going to be crowned Joe McDonagh champions, in your opinion?
Oh, God, you know, I think like Kildare have done unbelievably good work, but I just have a wary feeling that the experience of Laois will really stand to them. You don't lose a Joe McDonagh Cup final in agonising fashion like that, and you don't come in then without all your guns loaded next time around. So that experience could be crucial, Shane. As they say, Kildare are playing the better hurling, and they have been there in the final in Christy Ring Cup previously. They've won a few titles, so their players are well used to it. If Kildare hit the ground running with no baggage and no nerves, they're probably playing better hurling at the moment. But it's hard for me to look past that experience factor and the fact that they were beaten a few weeks ago. They'll surely be going all out and have every kind of inch of video analysis covered to see where they can get one over in Kildare this time around.
Okay, all will be decided on Sunday. Elsewhere, Damien, there was a media release from the GAA yesterday regarding an amateur status review committee survey that was issued by the association. What does this entail?
Well, basically, I can boil it down to this. Like, in 2024, there was €44 million spent on inter-county teams. That has been described by the GAA president as unsustainable. So I think the amateur status of the organisation is one of the key pillars of Jarlett Burns' presidency. And, you know, he set forward, you know, an amateur status review committee headed by Professor David Hassan. And they took office when Jarlett Burns took office. But now they're asking the public to help inform them and inform the direction that they want to take in terms of looking at areas like excessive spending on team prep, demands being placed on inter-county players, a review into the amateur status, stuff like the approval or not of overseas training camps, players having to take time off work, and establishment of maybe of a budget that would be capped by each county. Go back to COVID, Shane. Remember that? Remember the only certain people could get official expenses sanctioned, and everybody had a budget of a certain amount, and it worked very, very well. So an extensive survey has now been launched to canvass the views and members of stakeholders to see what they would like to keep or what they would like to loosen. So it's you know yourself, just the cost has gone through the roof here.
When you look at that headline alone, you might think that this is planting a seed or a soft launch for coming away from amateur status and coming away from that ethos of the GA. Now, I know Jarlath Burns isn't for that in any way, and he's come out and spoken about that. So is it more about conservative and responsible spending in finances?
I don't know. I think you make a good point. Like, the same thought occurred to me, you know, and like the survey will canvass the views. The committee itself will then probably report to next year's Congress or maybe special Congress in October I think the survey will be launched now. It'll be live until July the 25th. So let's see when they do come back with their findings. But here's the thing, like the possibility of manager, inter-county managers getting payments has been floated already. And the survey addresses that as one of four possible options. Another one is that managers should be paid in a manner consistent with that of an employee of the association. In other words, a form of wages, according to maybe key indicators, you know, along the way. And then there's another maybe suggestion that managers should receive only expenses consistent with the standard rate set out by Central Council. So the notion then of formal contracts and an agreed annual sum, they're all out there. So Shane, that might go along with what you've just maybe suggested as well. I think it's probably leading into the whole split season thing as well, Shane, because at the moment you have team managers, you've paid backroom personnel, paid provision of data, you know, obviously medical and nutritional and maybe mental well-being professionals involved as well. So it's really, really interesting. And I think the survey is going to inform a lot. And it's going to be asking, is the burden too much on inter-county teams as well, apart from the actual financial aspect of it as well?
Okay, certainly one to keep an eye on. Finally, Damon, before I let you go, there seems to be continued disharmony surrounding fixture scheduling. Certain games are being suffocated with throw-in times not spread out. We have the issue in a couple of weeks of Cork Camogie and Ladies Football Dual Stars having to pick and choose. Now, I know the Cork issue doesn't fall under the umbrella of the GAA as things stand, but broadly speaking, how big of a concern is the grassroots anger at fixture scheduling for the GAA, do you feel?
Yeah, it's big enough, like, and I think the survey that we've just spoken about is feeding into bits of that as well. Now, the National Competitions Control Committee has a tough job. It has to balance when counties are playing both codes. You have to get access to venues, and TV companies then, like ourselves and RT, are paying significant money to show the games. And I suppose then, if integration is on the way, it's going to be even trickier to sort out. So there's a lot of balls in the air, Shane, that the CCCC has to juggle. And I think one of the things that Jarlath Burns is looking at too was maybe kind of clipping back elements of the intercounty season. And among the survey we mentioned a few minutes ago is the question, like, should the GAA reduce the length of the intercounty season as a means of reducing the burden of amateur players? Well, if anything, I can understand the burden being placed on amateur players. I can definitely understand that. But I don't know how in the name of God you could reduce the length of the season as it is. Like, it's absolutely overwhelming from a professional point of view trying to cover it in the media. You know, you don't have any time to sit back and assess or review. You're moving on straight away. And I think the intercounty season extending into August has been ruled out by the president during his time. He was initially open into it, but because of counties like Galway, Cork, Wexford, Tipperary, where there's a dual championship to play, the possibility is they might take up to 12 to 16 weeks to complete those championships, and they have to be ready then for the provincial championships, which feed into coming into Christmas time. So how they're going to reduce it further is beyond me anyway. There's no doubt about it. The split season has increased the intensity and demand on county players. No doubt about that at all. Hurling people would feel that the FRC rules this year and the condensed calendar has definitely affected the profile of the game. So for many, many years there, people were bemoaning the standards of Gaelic football. This year it's different. It's wide open and it's explosive. And maybe the Munster Championship thus far hasn't really caught the fires that it has in the past. There's probably only 9 hurling games left for the season. And two of those include a prelim All-Ireland quarterfinals. There's a lot of anger over maybe the shortened end of the straw that hurling is perceived to be getting. There's no doubt about it as well. We've heard managers bemoan the fact in hurling that games haven't been televised on free-to-air TV. We've probably heard the fact that if you get it in football terms or hurling terms, if you get a soft injury, a soft tissue injury this time of year, your championship is in jeopardy. The rest of it is. You do a hamstring at this stage, you're in, you know, depending on the grade, you're in serious bother to get your season finished off. So, yeah, it's starting to become more and more about the scheduling difficulties. And, you know, last Saturday, Shane, we had maybe three big games throwing in roughly within an hour of each other. And I suppose that I look at other sports, and you might have a game at 12, you might have won a half 2, you might have won a half 4, you might have won a half 6 and 7, and there's a lovely spread across the day. We don't have that luxury here. I suppose we have two codes playing out here. You've got the Camogie and Ladies football going on at the same time, and then everybody has to be ready then for the second part of the season where the club goes at it full pelt as well. So yeah, to answer your question, every passing week is bringing maybe more and more attention to the condensed nature of the fixture scheduling. But again, this was all voted for just a couple of years ago. I've said it from the start. I do see this going into early August. I don't ever see it going back to September, but I do think you'll see it going into the first 2 weeks in August at the very, very least.
Okay, plenty to mull over. We'll leave the conversation there. You can hear more Gaelic Games chat with Damian Lawler on RTÉ Radio 1 Friday night, 10 o'clock with the Championship.
Game on.
Camogie.
Now it is time to chat Camogie in the company of Aoife Murray. And Aoife, only one place to begin our conversation. A first ever senior championship victory for Waterford over Kilkenny. How surprised should we be at this result? Or is it a case of Kilkenny weren't the team that they were in recent years and Waterford have been nicely building?
I think it's probably the latter. It's probably the latter. And I don't want to water down Waterford's victory either at the weekend, in fairness. And I think even if, like, from chatting here last week, you know, when we were looking at this, we're saying probably a really good opportunity for Waterford to beat Kilkenny at the weekend. As I said, I thought that the way they were finishing the league, they'd gone well in the Munster. It was kind of tipping away really nicely for them. And there was serious question marks over Kilkenny from the league and that kind of rebuilding phase. I don't think Kilkenny have found, I suppose, their starting or their finishing 15 and who are those impact people. So for me, I wasn't surprised that much that they actually won. I suppose it's just surprising. You get an automatic surprise when you see Kilkenny being beaten. You know what I mean? Mm. Whereas I think Waterford had been building to this moment. And in fairness, finishing that game really, really strongly.
Yeah, it was a fairly comprehensive victory. And also the fact that it was in Kilkenny.
Well, look, that's it. Well, you couldn't find two closer neighbours, you know. And I think Waterford probably, especially over the latter number of years, probably wouldn't have necessarily been too fazed by crossing the border into Kilkenny. For me, probably, especially with the conditions, Kilkenny probably didn't take advantage enough of them and started quite slowly. And I think that is probably one of the more impressive things with Waterford, you know. They win for it from the outset. And again, I know they've relied a lot on Carton and Rocket, but I would still say that there's a couple of names popping back up. And I think for me, I don't think Waterford would ever be fazed, especially with the confidence they've built over the last number of years, crossing the border and beating Kilkenny in Kilkenny.
Well, it certainly blows that group wide open. Waterford at home to Derry, 4 o'clock this Saturday. And you would imagine that will be a Waterford victory considering how the results have gone for Derry today. Two heavy defeats. For Dublin against Kilkenny this weekend, will it be a case of Dublin should be concerned that Kilkenny are going to be coming out looking for a massive response to that defeat? Or is it a big opportunity for Dublin to say, listen, Kilkenny, they're not what they used to be. They might be a bit rattled.
Yeah, look, if you were in the Dublin camp, right, and you're saying they put up a really good performance against Galway, or at least made it difficult for Galway to win that game, then they're looking across down to Kilkenny and going, you know, they've already lost that first game. So there's going to be huge pressure. Who's the more pressure on this weekend? There's more pressure on Kilkenny than there is on Dublin. So for me, Dublin should be going in there with the eye of going, you know what, if they show any weakness, we need to go after it and we need to pile the pressure on them from the absolute outset. And I think that's certainly, if I was in the Dublin camp, that's what I would be saying to them, is make them show their weakness and exploit it as quickly as you can. From the outset.
Okay, Dublin looking for their first win of the group. If we look at Group 1, Aoife, and I know you flagged this last week of how crucial the result of the Limerick-Wexford match would be in terms of group standings overall. I know we're only in, coming into round 3 of the group as such, but Limerick's victory over Wexford, 110 to 10 points, how big of a victory will that be for Limerick, kind of broadly speaking?
I think it's been a massive victory for them, especially to get it only in round 2. Right, because now all of a sudden they're sitting third in the table, right? And I know the table looks a little bit odd with Tipperary sitting at the bottom. They've only played one game, so everybody else has a game on them at the minute, bar Clare, right? And for me, you're looking at this and going, they're sitting now, two games in, they're sitting third. Like, that's a great position for them to be in. Of course, everybody wants to be at the top of the table, but for a team like Limerick, who are trying to rebuild and get themselves back up into that senior competitive status, sitting third, two games in, I think that's a phenomenal position for them to be in. And in particularly taking that scalp of Wexford, for me, I think it was a serious, significant victory for them.
When you're looking at the table, as you mentioned, Tipperary, you've only played one match, but they are at the foot of the table now. So 4 o'clock Saturday, Wexford against Tip, a lot on the line.
For both teams, because even Tipperary, I know it's their second game and Wexford are going into their third. But like, if Tipperary slip up here, it's going to be a serious uphill battle for them, even to get into the quarters. And, you know, Cork are sitting there pretty much comfortable at getting straight into that semi-final spot. So now all the other teams are fighting for second place. If Wexford go and beat Tipperary, all of a sudden they're going to jump up the table. So it would blow the whole group, I think, up in the sense of who's going to try and get that second spot, and effectively who's not going to get that bottom spot.
There's so much on the line. You can view the full tables in detail on the RT Sport website, because I'm looking at them here and there's just so many permutations already whirling around my head. But the fact that we're only at round two, going into round three as well. How impressive have Cork been, or is it kind of hard to judge considering the comprehensive manner of the victories?
I'd love to put my Cork hat on and try and play it down, right? And say, look, it's too early, etc. But I genuinely can't, because I think the manner that they've, in which they've gone about their business over the last couple of months, right? How they finished the league, they were probably going to be there or thereabouts in that Munster final. And then those first two games. What's been so impressive is Cork have pretty much done the same thing year on year, and nobody has been able to counter it. Like, if you look at how they played at the weekend, right? It was literally a one bounce pass out to the side. Mackey takes it, sucks in three players, passes it over to Finn, bang in the net. Like, there isn't a huge amount of reinvention with how they've played. But it is the speed, it is the execution, and it is just the basic skill level. And that's probably one of the things I've been most impressive about them, is that basic skill. They don't take a second touch or a third touch. It comes up normally the first time. But in many ways, when I look back at that Cork-Tipperary match, like, Cork played it so simply. And Tipperary, especially the full back line, because Cork tried to avoid that half back line, because it is probably the strongest line for Tipperary at the minute. They avoided it over the half back line, one bounce, as I said, into the likes of Mackey or Amy, etc. But the Tipperary defence just fell for it every time. And that's probably the more disappointing thing when you try to look at it in a critical way from a Tipperary perspective, or any team that's coming up against Cork, is how are we consistently falling for this? At one stage at the weekend, Mackey got the ball and her marker stopped and just let the play go on, thinking that Mackey was going to take a second or two. Mackey had already played, right?
Yeah.
It had already happened in Mackey's head, and she was executing it. And Tipperary just stood and watched, you know? So I think if you were in opposition, you'd have to say, we have to stop falling for this every single time. But it's just the quality of the basic skill level, I think, personally, of that Cork whole panel, because what they can bring in fairness, it's extremely influential, the impact that they have, and the quality has not dropped when that bench has come in to finish that game.
Yeah, it's scary, the strength and depth, and Tipperary will certainly have to be a bit more cohesive against Wexford this weekend. Clare Limerick, and it kind of ties in with the Cork results when you're looking at the results to date. So Limerick take an absolute battering from Cork in round one. Then we mentioned the importance of that result in round two. So I do just want to finish our conversation asking about Clare Limerick here. Because again, and I'm not being cliched, there is so much on the line, because it is a case of, okay, Cork might be that step above, but when you take Cork out of it, then anyone can beat anyone. So Clare Limerick, how do you see this one playing out?
I find this probably one of the hardest games to call, right? If you look at the table, Clare is sitting second, but they've only had one game. Limerick have had two, won one, lost one, right? But in fairness, are pretty consistent with how they've gone about things. I would say, for me, Clare might be that little bit stronger, had a really good league. But I think if you're a Limerick and you're coming in after a serious victory, you would have to be going into this game going, we have an opportunity. So could you imagine this time next week, we're chatting, Cork are on top of Limerick are second. Like, that is what is on. That is what is on the line for the likes of a Limerick. Imagine after round three for Limerick, they're sitting second. You would not have drawn that out a couple of weeks ago. So for me, it's probably one of the biggest games of the weekend, because it is one of the hardest to call for me. Because if Limerick play out of their skin, they have a serious opportunity here. If Clare can pull together a full 60, 65 minutes, then they have a serious opportunity to stay second. So like it's really interesting. It'd be really interesting this time next week to see what that table will look like.
Okay, I cannot wait to review all of that with yourself, Aoife, next week. Just to round up and confirm, Group 1, it is Clare against Limerick, Wexford against Tipperary, Wexford and Tip both looking for their first victory of the campaign. Group leaders Cork are idle this weekend. And then in Group 2, it is Dublin against Kilkenny, again as outlined some much on the line for quarterfinals, or perhaps trying to avoid a relegation playoff, and indeed Waterford against Derry. Galway, who are the group leaders, are idle as well. Aoife Murray, thank you so much for taking the call. Great chatting as always.
Game on.
Camogie.
Game on.
Ladies football.
So, Nadine Doherty, all four provincial winners are in action this weekend for the first round of the All-Ireland Championship. On Saturday, champions Kerry begin their defence of the title against Mayo Division 1 League finalists and early pace setters Armagh face a tough test away to Meath, and Connacht champions and many people's favourites Galway are at home to Tipperary on Sunday. Waterford, who pushed Kerry all the way in that Munster final, will have to be at their best again in Dungarvan as they take on Dublin. Donegal, Cork, Kildare and Leitrim have an extra week to prepare for their first round games. Three teams in each group. As we know, two from each go through to the quarterfinals, and the reward for top in the group is a quarterfinal against a second placed team. So let us begin with Group 1. So Galway against Tipperary, Chiam Stadium, 2 o'clock on Saturday. It was a handy Connacht championship for Galway. Will this be a handy fixture on Saturday?
No, I don't think so, Shane. And while Connacht was handy, I think we'll see another level to Galway this weekend. I think we spoke about this last week. You know, they've likely tapered their training knowing that they wouldn't be challenged in Connacht. I think they will top this group, but I don't think they'll have it all their own way this weekend. You know, we've seen in patches what Galway are capable of. I think they'll be looking this weekend to, I suppose, improving their forward play, Shane, improving their finishing. But Tipperary are the kind of team, they play a very, very low block in defence. They're really well organised. They like to get bodies back, and they're very hard to break down when they're on form. So I think Galway will have to move the ball a lot quicker than they have been. They haven't had to move the ball that quick, I suppose, because they've been against lesser opposition. But I could see it being close in a sense till maybe the last quarter, the last 20 minutes, and Galway then pulling away. And I think a big difference between these two teams, Shane, is the options off the bench. I mean, Galway have 12 to 15 forwards in their panel who could make most other inter-county teams. And I think with Tip, and I suppose it's been holding Tip back for a while, and through no fault of their own, they can blame the Aussie rules as well. You know, they've always played off a really small squad. And you know, if Ashley Maloney has an off day, sometimes it's hard to see where those scores come from. But look, they'll be hoping she'll be on form. They'll keep that defence tight, but I do expect Galway to win.
Okay, Galway are flying Connacht. Mayo, not so much. They're away to Kerry. Austin Stack Park, actually, 2 o'clock throw in. A big, big task for Mayo.
Yeah, Shane. You know, you go from playing Galway 2 weeks ago, who are one of the favourites of the All-Ireland, straight into the All-Ireland champions away. Look, Mayo will set up for straight Kerry. I don't think there'll be an attempt on behalf of their sideline to go and win this game. I think it'll be damage limitation. Kerry's level of performance, it's dipped a little bit, Shane, since their league title won in Croke Park. They'll be looking to put up a big score, I think, and get their forward line moving again like we saw a couple of months ago. But yeah, look, it'll be a straightforward win, I think, in that one.
Yeah, even Kerry looking to step up a gear from what they have in Munster,
yeah,
coming
exactly
up against Mayo, who have, I must credit yourself with this stat, Nadine, one victory in 11 games in this calendar year, so not ideal. Meath Armagh, 3 o'clock, Pádraig Tailte and Navan, potentially game of the weekend?
Yes, I think so. And I'm hoping, my fingers are crossed, possibly the return of Amy Mackin. And look, Shane, Armagh.
What have you heard?
Do you know what it was? It was probably 2 months ago now, and I was speaking with Joe Feeney, their joint manager, and he had said that Amy was back training at that stage. She was there in the match day squad for the Ulster final, so I'd imagine and I'd hope that she will get some game time this weekend. Look, they're a different team with her, and she's absolutely class. You know, it's always a spicy match, these two teams. It's always physical, it's always hard hitting. I think it'll be an excellent one. And look, Meath will definitely want to get out of the blocks. They performed really well in that Leinster final in Croke Park. They're at home. I do fancy Armagh, but I think if they get over the line, it'll be by the minimum. And equally, look, Meath are more than capable of getting a big win at home. What's definite is that it'll be physical, it'll be fast, it'll be a great game of football, I think.
Okay, well, a great game of football you can watch on TG Carr. The other two matches we spoke about will be live on the Sport TG Carr YouTube channel. Also live on TG Carr on Sunday, Waterford against Dublin in Dungarvan. Half one throw in for that one. Speaking of players being lost to Australia, big blow for Waterford.
Yeah, just heard this week that Kellyanne Hogan has headed off to hook up with Collingwood. You know, I would have had Waterford in that top five bracket, you know, definitely challenging those teams who are up for the All-Ireland this year, but she's a massive loss to them, Shane, you know. And I think Dublin will be delighted that she's gone. I still expect an intense game. And if Waterford do match their level of performance that they showed us in that Munster final, they're in with a big chance. Dungarvan's a hard place to go to, Shane, and get a result, and Dublin will know that. They'll be fully aware of the challenge of Waterford. They respect Waterford, they do, you know, they know it'll be physical. I think for Dublin, if they win their own kickouts, they avoid that, but they avoid the physical tackle, they move the ball quickly, I think they should get over the line. But as I said, you know, they are favourites, but you know, Waterford on their day can challenge anybody and they can cause an upset here. But okay, Dublin should get over the line.
Okay, just before we finish, we'll be reviewing, previewing all of that next Wednesday. Let's you know, get it on record here now. Group winners, are we going with Galway, Kerry, Armagh, Dublin, as expected? Is it that predictable, Nadine? Is it that easy for you?
It's not that easy for me, but I do. I think Galway, Kerry, Armagh, Dublin, and then Waterford, Meath, Cork and Tip to go through.
Okay, well, you were bang on in the provincials, yeah, so well, we shall see.
We shall see.
Listen, Nadine, thank you as always. We'll chat to you again next Wednesday. Big thanks to Lauralee Davis and Andrew O'Connor working on this evening's show. Do not go anywhere, because up after the news, and we take a short ad break, Beda da Silva will bring you the new music show. Game On is back from 6 o'clock tomorrow. From all of the team, have a great evening.